Welcome to the Alcohol Addiction Podcast. My name is Lee Davey. I'm not an alcoholic. I refuse to be anonymous. I am someone that doesn't drink alcohol. And I spend every waking moment helping other people do the same. Very short and sweet intro. Not going to bang on too much. I'm currently still in Montenegro working at a Triton poker series, high stakes poker tournament. And I'm going to be back in the UK next week. Probably release a solo episode next week because I've been a bit busy, so I haven't lined up any guests. But we do have a guest today. His name is Jeremy Miller. As a child actor born and raised in Southern California, Jeremy Miller was most widely known for portraying Ben Seaver on the popular 80s sitcom Growing Pains. Following his own struggles with alcoholism, Jeremy worked as a patient advocate at the former Start Fresh Recovery Clinic for 3 years and wrote an article on alcoholism for In Recovery magazine. Jeremy is an avid reader, terrible golfer, tennis player, and CrossFit enthusiast. His deepest joy comes from working with others in recovery and spending time with his family and friends, usually cooking for them. In this interview, we discuss the interesting tale of a young childhood star growing up in the Hollywood limelight, his descent into alcoholism and his recovery through BioCore X recovery. I found this guy to be a real sweetheart, and next time I'm in Los Angeles, which is going to be the end of August, I'm going to tap him up and go out and have a cup of tea with him. I loved the way that he was very open to talk about anything. I think when you become like a Hollywood star or a star in any other kind of industry and you get yourself a platform, I think it's really important that you talk about your struggles, right? It's why we say at the True About Alcohol that we're not alcoholics, we refuse to be anonymous. The reason that we don't want to be anonymous is because we need to help people. And that's what Jeremy Miller is doing. And talking about helping people, if you want to help yourself, then please head over to Strive and join the group. Jeremy talks a lot about the importance of support groups. Well, we have that at Strive. And he also talks about the importance of doing the work long-term. So if you want to get into that, then we have the Truth About Alcohol Taster and the Truth About Alcohol Intensive. Just send me an email at thetruthaboutalcohol@gmail.com and we'll get you enrolled in those programs. Without further ado, I'm going to shut the hell up and leave you in the capable arms of former Growing Pains star Jeremy Miller. Welcome to the Alcohol Addiction Podcast, Jeremy. My wife is a big fan, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Please tell her I said hi. We had such a blast on Growing Pains. It really was just like an ideal situation for a kid.
Yeah, being from the UK, Growing Pains wasn't something that crossed my radar, but my wife is from Los Angeles and we spend 6 months of the year there. So when I said I was interviewing, she was like, whoa, the Seaver kid. To start there, I mean, when I was 6 years of age, you know, I'm just kicking a football around a park every day. You were doing 3 to 4 auditions trying to be an actor. I mean, I don't even remember being 6. Do you remember being that young? And if so, what was it like back then?
I do vaguely remember what it was like, kind of the grind and, you know, having to leave school each day and do your homework in the car and go on auditions and you just ran around. But it was my life. I didn't know anything different, you know. I mean, it really was just a part of my life, so it never seemed that strange to me. My brother was auditioning as well, so it really was just my family. It was me and my mom and my brother. Every day just in our car. I mean, we lived in our car driving 3-4 hours a day for auditions and doing homework. And it was a crazy life, but being all I knew, it was just my life.
Was it something that you enjoyed? So I'm thinking, for example, you know, my sisters used to play the violin and my mom would say, right, you have to play the violin. And they would be like, I don't want to play the fucking violin. And was you there at the auditions? I don't want to audition. Or was you like really loving it?
Actually, I really loved it. I was very lucky that I didn't have any of that. Like, my mom never pushed me when I didn't want to towards this. It was never... I mean, getting started at 5 years old, it wasn't like, oh, I dreamed of this since I was born. I mean, it was only 5 years old, so I didn't really have that kind of dream at that age. But I did run around the house as a kid, kind of repeating, not even repeating, but acting out lines from my favorite shows. So even at 5, I was running around the house acting out Brady Bunch and all these other classic shows from my childhood. And it was just something I did randomly. My mom didn't think anything of it. She wasn't like immediately, oh, we got to get this kid in the business. Or she just happened to put me in singing classes. And the lady who taught the singing classes, her kids were actors. Mm. She also had, you know, the studio she worked at also taught acting and commercial classes and things like that. So it just kind of fell into place. She saw my personality and mentioned to my mom that, well, you know, he's cute and he never shuts up. You might want to see about putting him in, you know, in the business. He might be good at it. And it just kind of went from there. My mom asked me, you know, would you want to give it a shot being like one of those kids on TV? And you know, for a five-year-old, it was just like, oh yeah, cool, let's try it. Came to find out I really enjoyed it, and it just became a real love of mine.
My daughter's a little cutie. She's 2.5, and I think it was about, yeah, this time last year when I was back in Cardiff, we both spoke about, oh, maybe she could be a model, maybe she could be like a little child star or something, and we went to do it, and then we thought, I don't know, like whether she, you know, like she's too young to know whether that's the right thing or not. What's your thoughts on it now after experiencing it? Because obviously children at that age can't really make a choice. You went through the process. What would you do with your own kids, for example?
Personally, when it came to my kids, I was not against them being involved in the business, but unless it was a real driving passion for them, like it was something they had to try, they had to experience, I encourage them to stay away from it. Mm. Not because there's anything wrong with it, but it is a tough business, and it's a very unsure way to live. And I honestly don't recommend it to anyone if you have something else you love and that you can earn a living at and be happy at, because 99% of the people who follow this path will end up failing, and not through any, you know, any problems of their own. It just is the nature of the business. I mean, I have friends right now who have been nominated for Academy Awards who haven't had a job in 5 years.
Wow. It's crazy.
Now, you're in a business where you reached the pinnacle of your level, and then within 5 years, you're not working through no fault of your own. This isn't some corporation where you ruined everything. I mean, you were nominated for an Academy Award. You did the best performance you could possibly do. And a couple years later, you're out of work. That's a tough business to be in. So then you throw in all the other things that can happen with kids. I was lucky. I had a very strong mom. I had good family that was around me who was very, very protective. Not overly, but they were smart. You know, you don't let a little kid run around a set or anywhere else where a bunch of adults are around. You don't let them run around a party or a publicity gathering, the types of things we used to be at all the time, you know, 300, 400 adults and, you know, a few kids running around taking pictures. Things can happen. Now, did I see anything? No. Did anything happen to me directly? No. But I have friends who, you know, have stories about the back rooms and places like that and stuff like, you know, things happen. I was very lucky in that my mom and my family they were responsible. They did what parents should do. You know, they were by my side all the time during those times. And when they weren't able to, they made sure somebody that was trusted was there at all times. I didn't see that all the time with all my friends who were in the shows.
Yeah.
A lot of times they would be on set alone. A lot of times they'd be at events with, oh, just a random family friend and things like that. That was a recipe for problems sometimes. Mm. I mean, we'd walk into a party and occasionally you'd see a pile of Coke 6 inches high sitting on a table in the middle of the room. You know, my mom would walk me in, we'd see that. She'd take me, she'd take me right to where the pictures were being taken. We'd get our pictures done so everybody would see I was there, and we'd make a beeline out of the room.
Yeah.
You know, we'd be leaving that event. But not everybody did that. So If your kids want to get in, anybody, this is for anyone out there, if they want to get into this business and they want to try it, it's on you to make sure that they're okay. Hmm. Listen to your kid, make sure they're enjoying this, make sure this is something they want to do, and then just be there to protect them, because it's on the parents. It absolutely is.
I mean, just to underline how difficult this business is, as you said, before you got the role of Ben Seaver, you went through like 300 auditions, right? So that's 300 auditions.
It was almost 400.
Right, so almost 400 auditions, not getting the part. How do you, that to me screams crushing disappointment. How did you keep going? How did that affect you? Was the fact that you were a kid helped? You know, what was it like?
I think being a kid does help to a degree. You have that natural thick skin and armor when it comes to that kind of thing. You know, you're not as self-critical at a young age. And then on top of that, my mom was very good at helping me to understand that the nature of this business is such that most of the time, it's not that you're not good enough. It's that you don't fit the role. They need somebody taller, fatter, skinnier, blonder, brunette, redhead, whatever it is. There's something, some quality that I may be missing that they're looking for. And it's not a criticism every time on my performance or what I was able to do. And my mom was very good at getting that across to me and making sure that I kept that in my mind. When I was auditioning and going through all that rejection. Because, I mean, I got my first job was a McDonald's commercial. And I got it within my first 10 auditions.
Wow.
So, I mean, as a kid, you're like, oh, this is easy. You know, this is going to be a breeze. We're just going to work on. And then after that, it was 2.5 years, almost 3 years of nothing. And again, I got really far. Almost every audition, I would get to the final rounds of auditions. I'd go to the producers, the directors. I'd get down to the final me and two other kids, but I never got it. So there was a lot of positive and a lot of hope, but it just never came through during that time. So I was just really blessed to have a mom that, A, didn't push me when I didn't feel good about it, or I didn't feel like I was... When I was getting down about getting, you know, rejected so much, things like that, she was very, very good at keeping me focused and kind of helping me just let that stuff go. Mm. And truthfully, it really did. I was able to, and still to this day, I'm really able to kind of step back and not be so critical of my performance and maybe look for why I wasn't a fit for this role rather than just shredding myself as a alcoholic mind will tend to do.
Well, you've had enough. That those 300 rejection slips, as authors would call it, that certainly gives you the right kind of training for when you're older. Sounds like your mother was a really, really priceless mentor for you when you were younger.
She really was. We always said we grew up together. She had me when she was 19, and her and my father separated when I was 2.5. So it was basically just my mom and me and my little brother. I did get to see my dad. We had a great relationship, very typical 80s divorce relationship, saw him every other weekend. And my dad was great. But my mom was the one who was there for everything. And she really was my, like you said, kind of crisis manager. You know, she did the crisis intervention for me always. There was just an understanding there, you know, like most moms, she knew, she could just kind of tell and sense what was affecting me the most and was very good at guiding me through that. I was very, very blessed.
I can imagine when you're, you know, you're around 6, 7, 8, 9 and you're in this business, it's very, very different to when you become 10, 11, 12, 13, right? Because around that, I remember being 10. And I thought I was a man. I was like, I'm not doing what you're telling me to do. You know, and so what was the change like from being a child towards approaching your teenage years? Because you've got, you know, you're in this very adult world. There's this schooling, there's socializing, there's wanting to kiss girls or boys or whatever it takes your fancy. I mean, where was you around moving into your teenage years?
things got tough around my teenage years. Right around 11, 12 years old is when I started really kind of experiencing my anxiety issues and things like that. A lot of that had more to do with my stepfather at the time. Hmm. He kind of set out to break me, you know, emotionally, whatever you want to call it. I was a very self-confident kid. I mean, I wasn't an arrogant, obnoxious kid, but I was self-confident, you know, and he kind of set out to break me of that. So yeah, that self-doubt really started creeping in around 12 years old or so, very soon after he had entered my life. And yeah, it made things more difficult. I never had that rebellious streak towards the show. I think the only conflict we ever had like that around the teen years, which was very ridiculous and funny, was I wanted to have my hair long, and they wanted me to have it short for the show. And we actually got into a battle of wills over this, to the point where they called my agent and were basically like, he's got to cut the hair or we're going to recast him. I mean, this is, you know, that's the only, I guess, teen angst, rebellious thing I had with the show directly. For the most part, I guess from doing it from a young age, even when I got to my teen years where I might be a little more adverse to cooperating, I knew I needed to carry myself as a professional. So if they asked me to do something, it wasn't even in my mind that it was something I could rebel against. It was, this is my job. They need this from me, and this is what I'm going to do. So on that end, there wasn't any real conflict. But the self-doubt, that self-confidence just naturally you have as a kid most of the time, had already started to kind of go away. Mm-hmm. Self-awareness, throw in my stepfather and kind of the self-esteem issues that were going on with that. And yeah, anxiety hit pretty hard. And then acting and being in the public eye gets a little difficult. Especially when you are going through puberty in front of millions of people. Mm. You know, no teenager feels good about themselves during those puberty years. Your face is breaking out, you're awkward, you know, all that kind of stuff. And doing that in front of millions was difficult. Kids at school can be mean. I never had a lot of guy friends at school, especially once the show was going. You know, with the show being as popular as it was, I'd go to a new school, and sure enough, every girl would want to date me. All the girls wanted to be my friends, and the guys hated me because of that. Mm, yeah. So it was very difficult to make guy friends. And I don't know, it was... It was hard knowing who you could trust. It was hard knowing at that age who you could be friends with. And because of the puberty thing, and because they were looking for ammo against me, I got shredded at school. I'd get shredded at home. You know, the kids would pick on me pretty hard. And for the most part, that didn't faze me until later. I still had a pretty good coat of armor when it came to the kids and stuff. Now, by 12, I was tearing myself apart. The anxiety and the self-criticism and all that kind of stuff, 12, 13, was really starting to kick in heavy.
When you say it was difficult to know who to trust, are you talking about who wants to be your friend because you're Jeremy Miller and who wants to be your friend because you're Ben Siever?
Yeah, that's exactly what I meant. A lot of times, especially going to a new city or a new school, you don't know who is interested in you for what reason.
Yeah.
I did have friends who I noticed kind of buddied up to me to get popular. And they'd get a lot of friends and they'd get more in the, and then they'd start in with the making fun of me and picking on me and making fun of the show and different things like that. I got to the point where I would occasionally tell my closest friend that show had been canceled and that I wasn't going to be acting anymore, just to see their response. And sure enough, even at, you know, 13, 14 years old, a lot of them would disappear. You know, wouldn't call me anymore, wouldn't, you know, would avoid me at school, stuff like that. And, you know, now, of course, especially in recovery, I know that's very manipulative. It's not stuff I would do now, but at the time it was all I knew to do, you know, to kind of make sure that these people actually cared about me. Now, given because of that, I've ended up with some very wonderful and true friends, in my life. I've been very blessed that I've got a solid handful plus of people I can count on at any time. Kind of because of that, because I've weeded through a lot of the phonies, and my personality is I'm a lover. I'm friends with everybody. If I meet you and we talk for 10 minutes, dude, you're my buddy. I love you. I'll, you know, if I can help, I will. That's just me. And that gets taken advantage of a lot. But it's just who I am. So weeding through all that, going through all the different people who have screwed me over, who've used me, stuff like that, has left me with a very, very strong core of friends and people that aren't even friends anymore. They're chosen family. And I guess that's a real blessing to kind of come out of the negative side of that, is that the ones who did make it through all of that craziness have been the type that, you know, stick with you through the fire.
It also shows you you had a very strong level of emotional intelligence when you were younger, because I can imagine there are a lot of kids around that age who don't really give a shit why people are friends with them as long as they're popular, where you were kind of thinking, no, I want this to be authentic. And that's unusual for a 10, 11, 12-year-old. So, you know. The other thing is I'm a divorcee. Is that the right word? I'm a divorcee. So me, ex-wife and me divorced when my boy was 10. And I remarried a wonderful woman called Liza from Los Angeles, like I said. And so I spent half of the year in LA and half of the year here in the UK so I could see my boy. And I know that he at 10 had incredible issues with the whole stepmom, dad kind of like triumvirate, you know. And then later on when we had a kid, even that was complicated. And the one thing I realized is, as much as me and my boy had a really good, solid, strong relationship and he could tell me anything, when it came to the problems he had with this whole new family that was just dumped on him that he never asked for, he struggled to be able to talk to me because he felt he couldn't do that because it was my wife. Did you have a similar type of thing where you felt like you was in a bit of a coffin and you couldn't talk to anyone about your issues with your stepfather?
Absolutely, I did. You know, my mom's happiness was the most important thing to me. You know, she had been alone for a long time, and not that she made it a point to let us know, but I mean, as a kid, I wasn't oblivious and I knew how unhappy she was and lonely. So seeing somebody who made her happy made me happy. And I didn't want to rock the boat or talk about the issues that we had. I confided in Tracy. Tracy Gold, who played my sister on the show, was pretty much my confidant on the set. And her and one other person were really the people that I unloaded to when things got too much at home. So it wasn't that I didn't have anybody, but yeah, it's a very common thing, I think, for kids of divorce to not feel like they can talk to their birth parent about those issues because, you know, who wants to rock the boat? Who wants to ruin your parents', you know, newfound happiness after whatever they've been dealing with after divorce and suffering? And I mean, kids aren't blind. They see the sadness in their parents and, you know, the struggle and all that kind of stuff. And who would want to add to that? So you kind of swallow it and you deal with whatever problems come up and, you know, you don't communicate it as much. And that's, you know, non-communication is never healthy. But there's a natural instinct to protect your parents.
Yeah, when I don't necessarily see the pain in Jude more than when he talks about it, I see the release. I feel this release. Oh, you know, I got my boy back, you know. Terrible, complicated situation. So this social anxiety starts to creep in, you're under the in this intense spotlight, and we live in a world where alcohol is just everywhere. I mean, you talked about going to events where there's towers of cocaine on the table. I mean, there must have been booze everywhere as well. What are your earliest memories of alcohol, Jeremy?
My personal earliest memory is around 11 or 12. Actually, it was about 12, 12 and a half. That's my first real memory of drinking and experimenting with alcohol. Now, we have the family stories, which have been told for long before that, of me at 4 years old running around my grandparents' house after their parties, finishing off all the beers. And apparently that was a regular thing for me after my grandparents' parties. And I would just keep going until I passed out in my grandpa's chair. So apparently, even at 4 years old, I never had that off switch. You know, I would just go. I liked the feeling and I would go and go and go until I couldn't do any more. But around 12, I went to there's a big beach volleyball event happening. And a friend of mine had backstage passes for the whole weekend. And we were going down to the beach to watch the tournament and have fun. And we got up that morning and yeah, we started in with the beers, probably about 10 a.m. And I polished off about a case before 6 p.m. Then we went to another party and I kept tying on beers. I have no idea how many I had, but got violently ill, threw up in this poor guy's, some guy's house, I don't even know, threw up in his sink in his kitchen. And then like any good alcoholic, promptly went right back to the cooler and got another beer. And that was at 12 years old. So that's my first real memory of drinking and getting drunk. And again, to way excess. I mean, over the course of the day from 10 to 2 in the morning, I probably drank 30 beers at 12 years old. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Was it everywhere around your work as well, around the set? And what's the drinking culture like in Hollywood when you were in and about it?
There's really not much of a drinking culture in that you don't find people partaking on set or usually find them drinking on filming or anything like that. There was usually some alcohol around the set, you know, a bottle of champagne for a celebration, the occasional bottle of whiskey in the prop room for the guys to share after a night's filming, that kind of thing. But for the most part, the alcohol was readily available at the events. You know, if we'd go to a publicity event or we'd go to a Christmas party or some sort of party for ABC, those kinds of things, there were open bars generally. It was very easy to get alcohol there.
And I'm going to ask you this question. I'm going to go completely off a tangent and then come back to my narrative. But it just struck me. Do you know, ever since I got sober a decade ago and I started to create experiences to help other people do the same, and I watch a lot of TV shows and movies and stuff, I am astounded by the level of alcohol in each episode what I'm watching. To the degree I'm starting to think that the alcohol industry pays Hollywood in order for them to actually have more scenes where they're drinking wine or not even branded, just so I'm not saying that Jack Daniels is paying them to show Jack Daniels, the brand, but they're paying them to show whiskey, people drinking whiskey. Is there any truth to that, or am I just making this up?
I think it's definitely possible. Now, I know that branding has gotten so big, especially in the smaller films. Right now, that's one of the biggest ways to get a small film funded.
Right, right. So like the classic scene with the Apple Mac or a certain type of car. Yeah,
exactly. Those things right now, especially for the smaller films, are a big source of revenue to actually get the film produced. So I definitely can't say that it doesn't happen the other way as well, where maybe... Because, I mean, there are liquor coalitions and things like that that kind of watch out for all the brands overall and things. I can't say that they don't pay. You know, we know for a fact that the cigarette makers did that back in the 40s and 50s. So I don't think it's that out of the question to believe that the alcohol companies would do that as well. Now, I do think there's another side to that as a filmmaker. Unfortunately, alcohol is a very pervasive thing in our society. You know, it's pretty much everywhere. I think when you're trying to create realism in a film, if your reality is one that alcohol is very heavily involved with, when you're putting together that story, that will be something you will include quite a lot. I don't have as much of a problem with that. I really don't. As a filmmaker, I am all for realism and whatever it takes to elicit the emotional response the filmmaker is trying to accomplish. I don't have a problem with that. But I think if they are trying to push more alcohol and more use of alcohol just in a general way to create more of an acceptance and more of a normality, that's dangerous, of course. But the truth is, I mean, I go back to kind of the old AA saying that, you know, it's one I've grabbed onto years ago. You know, people don't have to change for me. I need to change for the people around me. So, you know, very early in my sobriety, most of the people around me were very worried about putting any alcohol around me. You know, they were worried about drinking in front of me or anything else like that. And I understood that the hell I put them through for years and years and years, that's a natural reaction. But what I explained to them over the years was, if you want to have a drink, go ahead and have a drink. I'm okay. You know, you don't have to change your life and your behavior for me. I need to change. If it makes me uncomfortable, then I need to find out how to deal with that. I need to work on how I can affect that, not how you can change to make me feel better. So I kind of have that feeling with it too, with the films, is that, yeah, it may be a little overkill the way they constantly are showing alcohol use and even alcohol abuse without showing the consequences. But at the same time, as an alcoholic, you know, should they be changing that to make us feel comfortable? No, not really. You know, it's if it's something that makes me feel uncomfortable, if I'm not feeling spiritually fit at that point in time, and I go and choose to go see that, well, that's on me. And if it disturbs me, then I'm going to need to deal with that afterwards.
I mean, I take a slightly
off topic. There was a great film called Drunks with Richard Lewis, great comedian, but it was a very serious film. And it very much talked about that personal responsibility of the alcoholics and how, I mean, it's a very dark, depressing film, but it really delves into that reality of how it's us trying to change to fit us to the world around us, not trying to change the world. And it was a very like powerful point that they were driving home, and the realism that they showed and the excess of drinking and everything made a point that was so poignant that I don't think you could have taken anything out of that film and still had it make the same effect.
I remember watching Goliath. I think it was on Amazon Prime, I think, with Billy Bob Thornton in it. And that was one where they did show the consequences of alcoholism, but they made it cool. They made the consequences cool. So they made this fuck up drunk look really fucking cool. And that angered me, but I take your point on that, you know, about responsibility. I think what bugs me the most is seeing superheroes do it. So like seeing Aquaman portrayed as a drunk, or the scene in Justice League where we show on our programs where Batman is giving Wonder Woman a tumbler of whiskey, and you're thinking, why is that there? What's the point of that, you know?
I agree. I have an issue with that as well. I think from the Hollywood side, there's a tendency and a movement over the last 15 years or so to humanize and to make everything more real to life, more true to life. Unfortunately, I think that has reached some of our ideals, which would be the superheroes. You know, they don't want the classic old Superman, you know, perfect in every way, no flaws, no faults. They don't want to show that for some reason now. Mm. Now they want to humanize them. They want to show all the faults and all the cracks and all the things. And I think that's where a lot of that comes from. And I understand it as a filmmaker, but at the same time, as a society, having that ideal to strive for and have that as something the kids are looking at, you know, as an ideal of goodness and hope and all that stuff, I think that's a good thing. I don't think we need to humanize that to the point where they're like every other POS on the earth. You know what I mean?
I see the filmmaker almost... Like, we need to show Batman, he's not a superhero like everybody else, he's a man. So how to show he's infallible, we give him whiskey, right? Right, I get that. But what they're missing is, very few people are going to get that connection. The kids are just going to see, oh, fucking Batman's cool because he drinks whiskey. Aquaman's fucking cool and sexy. Because, you know, that for me is especially in a society where I would argue every single one of us, no, that's not true. Let me repeat that. The vast majority of us end up drinking because, as Seth Godin always says, people like us do things like this. We drink because that's what we're supposed to do when we're a teenager and we're an adult, right? Then after we get into that, we drink for a variety of different reasons, whether to quell our social anxiety, whether to fit in, whether we love the taste and pair it with a certain meal or whatever. But in the beginning, we drink because it is the most acceptable drug in the world. And we all like to go into a different alternative reality. And that's why we do it. And so it angers me a little bit when I'm on an aeroplane and there's gin adverts in front of me on the seat and my kid sees, or I go to London Underground and I see an advert for whiskey, or I watch a TV show and there's alcohol. And it's not just alcohol, Jeremy. I mean, with the kids' shows, it's all about sweets and sugars. And it's the same thing, isn't it?
The way we use marketing now is ridiculous. And I mean, in all reality, it is our own modern day propaganda. Mm. I don't like it either. That's the truth. I mean, we've normalized it to the point where, like you said, it's expected. You know, when you turn 21 in the United States, it's expected that you're going to Vegas to get messed up. Yeah. Or you're going to it's almost become a rite of passage. Why? Because we've normalized it. Because the advertising and everything else tell us it's normal. Because the films tell us it's normal. You know, if you see a film and a kid's turning 21, what scene do you think is going to be in that film?
Yeah. But it goes
not going to be them sitting around with a birthday cake.
It goes back to what you said about really kind of separating the wheat from the chaff, right? You want to know who are your friends and who aren't your friends, right? So at a very young age, for Jeremy Miller, like everybody else who's that age, fitting in with the right crowd is really, really super important. So all of a sudden, if fitting in with that crowd is, and my son's just turned 18, so in the UK, you know, it's 18, it's your 21, right? So he turns 18. What's he going to do on his birthday, 18? He's going to get smashed. It doesn't matter what I say. It doesn't matter what his mum was supporting it, but it doesn't matter what I say. He's going to get smashed. Why? Because I have two dads. Because my mates expect me to, and if I don't, I'll have no friends and I'll be lonely for the rest of my life, you know? And it is super, super difficult. Super difficult. To the point, I wouldn't even know what advice to give a kid, whether to be lonely and not drink or to drink and have friends and figure it out later. I wouldn't even know.
I know what you mean. And it's there is such a distinct influence from the sources around us, you know, media, advertising, all those kinds of things. When I was a kid, the first billboard I ever read, my mother still laughs about this, was a Captain Morgan's billboard.
Right.
And, you know, not that there was anything as a kid, you know, 6 years old, whatever it was, that I was like, ooh, I got to go try Captain Morgan. But that advertising, it sticks.
It's there.
Years later, when I did start experimenting with hard alcohol, what alcohol do you think was near the top of my list to try?
Captain Morgan.
Captain Morgan. Because that was the first thing I remembered alcohol-wise reading about. Mm. And that curiosity was piqued. But my perception of it being normal, I think, came much more from it being acceptable around my house. Now, my mother was not a drinker. My mother's the type that'll have one pina colada and be like, whoo, that's too much. Mm. My dad's a teetotaler. He hasn't had a drink since I think he was 17 years old. But my grandparents were traditional, functional 70s alcoholics. Mm. You know, they never missed a day of work, never missed a car payment, never missed a house payment, but you could be sure that 5:05 when they got off work, they'd be at the bar. It was just normal to me. We always had beer in the house. By 7, 8 years old, when my grandparents would throw parties, I would be back there mixing martinis and gimlets and things like that for their friends. And it was just normal.
Yeah.
So that normality to me was just, oh, yeah, people drink. And when I get older, that's what I'm going to do. You know, it's just what's done. So that home influence for me was the much bigger influence, that normalcy there. Even by the time I started really becoming an alcoholic, as long as I felt, as long as I was maintaining my life, getting my bills paid, taking care of my responsibilities, that it didn't matter. Mm. You know, I saw that was how my grandparents had handled it. And in no way am I criticizing them for it. I adored my grandparents, but that was how they lived their life. They were very functional alcoholics. And to me, that was life. You know, it didn't matter how much you partied, how much you drank, how much you did, whatever. As long as you were handling your responsibilities, no big deal. So that normalcy played a very big part in my alcoholism. Because it was almost something to be, you know, to strive for. You know, the more you could drink, the more messed up you could get, but still take care. You know, that was a badge of honor.
It's because nobody ever tells you that it'll be difficult to stop. And even if you do tell someone, like I remember my boy saying to me, "Look, Dad, I know you do what you do. I'm really proud of you that you don't drink and that you help other people not drink. But I just need to let you know that I am going to drink. And the reason I'm going to drink is because of social reasons, right?" And I said to him, "Boy, you know, you can do what you like, but it's going to be tough down the road, you know, if it goes out of control." And he said, "Well, I'll just stop like you," you know, and it's like people have no idea how difficult it is to stop, you know?
Oh, tell me about it. I think thankfully most adults are starting to come to terms with how difficult addiction is. You know, we've started removing the stigma. Finally, more people are talking about addiction. We're starting to understand it more as a culture. Still slow going, but it's getting there. I think kids is where that's still, what you were talking about, is still really susceptible to that because they don't hear the gory details of addiction. I think most adults now have read the stories online. They've heard about the celebrities. They've heard about the people who've gone off the deep end, and they're much more aware of the possible consequences of, you know, addiction. But yeah, kids, I think especially if they, like you said, I mean, it's just a kid way of looking at it. Well, Dad did it. You know, if it gets to be a problem, I'll just stop like Dad. No problem. Yeah. And that's not on, you know, anything bad that we did. I mean, we got our lives together and we did our thing, but that's just a child's understanding of that kind of situation. I think thankfully the world is starting to understand more. Mm. I think that's one of the reasons why I'm so open about my recovery. It's not just to help other alcoholics, you know, I mean, that's really why I do it. And that's why I decided to be so public with my story. But I think the more of us, and I don't mean celebrities, I just mean people in recovery. I think the more we talk about it and the more we bring attention to addiction and what it really is, you know, the more we remove that stigma, the more people realize that, you know, these are not just awful human beings who, you know, have no worth. They're, you know, good people, smart people, caring people, loving people who are dealing with a monster.
When did you realize that you had a problem?
The first time I woke up and really had to have a drink in the morning, that's when I knew. That sent up every red flag in my head. That was probably around 24 years old, 25 years old. We had just finished filming the first Growing Pains reunion movie in Montreal. And man, Montreal was my city. I got up there and I'm like, ooh, everybody's drinking at lunch? I love this. Okay, wait a minute. Because I never. I was a, you know, just like my grandparents. You didn't drink till 5 o'clock. Mm. You know, I rarely did that. I would start drinking before I'd start making dinner, 4 or 5 o'clock, and then I'd get plowed through the night. Well, Montreal introduced me to the social concept of a few drinks at lunch. And I liked that idea. And soon after getting home from Montreal, I realized I woke up one morning and I had to have a drink. I needed a drink more than anything. And that sent up a lot of red flags in my head. I realized right then that I was well past the point where I could stop. Truth is, at that point, I didn't care. But I did realize it.
And when I was reading your book with you did with Brandon, it said that you tried AA and rehab and stuff, but it wasn't really sticking. What was not jiving for you when you was, we'll talk about how you got clean in a minute, but your attempts to get clean that failed, what was not jiving for you?
Well, the truth is it was me. I mean, I always will say that. I don't criticize any method of recovery. I have had friends who've gotten help with practically every modality out there. But the first time I went to AA, that really was my first attempt at recovery. It stuck at first. I think I made it almost 6 weeks. And then, unfortunately, I was sold out to the National Enquirer by my sponsor at the time. That was my first sponsor.
Right. Not very anonymous. Ashamed.
Oh no, that was a bad one. That was a bad one. And at that time, I was very ashamed of my addiction. You know, when I would go into meetings and things like that I was doing, I'd use a different name. I'd do all kinds of stuff. So to be outed like that and to be betrayed by the person that I was supposed to be able to trust most in my recovery was hard. And it kind of ruined my faith in AA for a while and in most forms of 12-step recovery because I just associated it all together. That betrayal really hurt. And like any good alcoholic, I jumped on it as an excuse, you know, for the next 6 years to just blow off that side of recovery. After that, yeah, I tried meditation. I tried holistic and herbal therapies. I tried what's called hydrotherapy, which is, you know, water immersion where you're trying to sweat out the toxins and different things like this. Tried self-help tapes. I mean, I literally tried every type of recovery, every little idea I saw on the internet. I was desperate. But again, I couldn't make it work. In particular, I think because the cravings were so overpowering, which is the part I was dealing with the most. I mean, I had that classic alcoholic battle every day, going down to the store, sitting in my car, screaming at myself in my head, don't go in there, don't buy the bottle, you know, still screaming as I'm paying for it, you know, screaming at myself as I'm opening it, you know, do not, you are losing everything. What are you doing? You know, I don't know how many times I'd go into the store, walk back out and get into my car, try and drive away, walk back in, walk back out. You know, it was a real struggle wanting to quit, but that craving was so overpowering for me. And I don't think I could really hear what people were trying to tell me in recovery. I don't think I really heard what was on any of those self-help recovery tapes. I don't think I ever really heard what was being said to me in the meetings and things like that. think my mind was so overwhelmed with that need that it wasn't getting through. I think that's one of the biggest reasons why I wasn't able to make those work, because I was desperate.
How did BioCorex? How did BioCorex recovery? Bio-Corex. Yeah, how did BioCorex recovery change that for you then?
When my mom actually found the BioCorex program, just by sheer chance, I had called her after a particularly nasty blow up and just said, "Mom, please, I need help. Please find me something." And she saw this little article, a little video blog that was done about this program that had started in Australia that used a medicine to help block the cravings. Mm. And of course, she thought, you know, we found a miracle. And immediately, she just saw the, you know, any parent who's got that hope. I mean, she just immediately thought, this is it. And she told me about it. And I immediately went, you know, I'm very practical in that way. I wasn't looking for an excuse out. I wanted this, but now I started picking it apart and I'm like, okay, great. They got a medicine that helps with the cravings, but then what? Cravings aren't, you know, what's driving this in the first place. And I'm still left with all those problems that make me want to drink in the first place. So what good is a medicine going to do me? But then I called them and started learning about it. And I learned that it's a whole program. It deals with counseling. It deals with the recovery coaching as well as the medicine. And I started to kind of believe that, you know, maybe this could work. And as I said, I was so desperate. If they would have told me that chopping off my left arm would guarantee me sobriety, I'd have done it. I mean, that sounds like an over-exaggeration, but it's not. I was that desperate that if they could have guaranteed me that chopping off my arm would make me sober, I'd have said, take it off. So the idea of having a little pellet that, you know, would dissolve inside of me, put in me, didn't sound that drastic to me at the time. Now, most people I tell about it afterwards, like, wow, really? You know, to them, it sounds very extreme. But to me, it didn't. It sounded like a, you know, an easy thing to give a shot. And, you know, I guess I didn't really believe it was going to work, but I was hoping. And it was like night and day for me. It was like a light switch got flipped off. I mean, it really was. It was that amazing. I had my procedure in the morning. Actually, it was closer to probably about noon, and it was 2 hours from my house. So driving home, we got stuck in a bunch of great LA rush hour traffic. It took us about 3.5 hours to get home. And when we got back, we were out of gas and we had to stop and get some. And my fiance Joni gave me $20 to go pay. And I ran inside the store and I blew right past the beers. I blew right past the alcohol. I didn't even look at them. And I paid for the gas and I walked out. And I actually stopped outside the door. And just like this feeling of, wow, what just happened, kind of came over me, because that was the first time in at least 10 years I had walked out of a gas station with no alcohol in my hand. And like I said, the thought didn't even cross my mind at that point. So for me, it was groundbreaking, because the biggest obstacle I had was those cravings. Once I could get past that and start really working my recovery, it was, I won't say easy, but infinitely easier than it had been before, when those cravings were just bombarding me constantly.
It's like if you're able to put a bit of time in, a bit of distance between your last drink, the more time that you put in, the more clarity that you get, and the more able you are to now hear people. Like you said, I wasn't hearing people, you know, when people were telling me, I was reading books and I wasn't really picking anything up. It's this fog, in it, that we have with this alcohol. And once it's cleared a little bit, people are starting to make more sense, and you get more energy, you get more into it. So it's good. It's good that they have that side of it, because you're quite right. There are a lot of people out there, a lot of companies out there at the moment that are peddling these pills that are going to stop you craving. But you're quite right. I mean, the craving might be there, but the reasons why we drink are so important. I always talk on Striving the Truth About Alcohol about getting to the root cause of our issues, because if we just lop off the weeds, it's just going to grow back again, man. You know, so
exactly. It's good to look at that. Well, that was one of the, I was very privileged to get to work with the company as a patient advocate for about 3 years after recovering. And I actually had the perfect experience to be able to talk to them about, because I did rely on the medicine.
Right.
After doing my first couple of counseling sessions, because it was so far away, it was very easy for me to blow off.
Mm.
So after doing a couple of them, I was feeling so good from the medicine. I wasn't craving anything. I just blew off the counseling. You know, oh, I'm fine. I'm doing great, you know. And sure enough, eventually the medicine wears off and life is still in session. And finances got hard. And that was right when the recession happened. And my fiance and I were struggling. And sure enough, I ran out and I grabbed a bottle. And after the thousands of times, and this is not something I say braggingly, this is something I say with great shame, after the thousands of times that I drove just smashed, this one relapse, this one little lapse, I got my one and only DUI. I pounded a pint of vodka, and about two blocks from my place, got picked up for a DUI. And that was the beginning of me starting my recovery over. I called up the people at BioCorrex and I asked them, you know, guys, could I complete my counseling? Can I go back and do the other part and finish up? And they said, you know, absolutely. They also asked if I wanted to have another implant, which I didn't feel I needed at the time. And I was able to do without, although over my years working with them, we did have many patients who wanted to have a second one, not because of need. It was more of a mental insurance policy. They felt more confident having a second one and knowing that they had another 6 months or more of, you know, not having to think about those cravings. But having failed, I was very uniquely suited to tell the patients kind of what did work and exactly where they could go wrong, you know, utilizing this program. And it's one of the reasons why I stress to everybody, and I still do, that no matter what you use to get sober, you're going to want some sort of support down the road. Whether that's a 12-step program, whether it's a whatever it is that you find that works for you, once you're sober, that's only half the battle. It's oftentimes the hardest part, getting sober, but staying there is also difficult. And without support, without people in recovery around us, most people I've seen fail. You know, most people are going back at some point. So I tell everybody, just from experience, how desperately important that is. We would get a lot of people when they're exploring medical options for recovery that have already had what they consider to be negative experiences with 12-step or things like that. And they're looking for something else. And they're already biased to a lot of the options. I always just try and let them know to keep their minds open, because some of these options may start making more sense to them once that fog clears.
We have an experience at the Truth About Alcohol called The Taster, where it's for people who are not ready to commit to being alcohol free forever. And then they can just come on board and we provide them with a support system and a series of coaching videos where they can try to be someone who doesn't drink alcohol for the month, right? But it's so good, Jeremy. It's so good that when they finish it, they think they've nailed it. And then they don't take the intensive, which where we work together for a year, right? They don't take it because they feel that they've nailed it. And then they go away and they leave the support system and they take all that confidence and they get in, and then something trips them up and they look around and there's nowhere to go. There's no one to understand them. They haven't quite grasped and mastered the knowledge and the information that they need to change all these neurological connections. We said, didn't we, Jay, you know, alcohol is everywhere. So our beliefs around alcohol and our beliefs around the Captain Morgan sign they're there subconsciously, and we need to change that programming, and it takes time. So if you're listening to this, folks, Jeremy gives you some real sage advice there. You need to work at this for as long as it takes, until not when you feel, but the people around you who've had all that experience can help you as well and say, I think you might have nailed this one. But, you know, we interviewed James and Janice Prochaska a couple of weeks ago. They wrote a book called Changing to Thrive, the six stages of change model. And they believe the maintenance model, which most people at the Truth of Alcohol and Strive are on, is 5 years. I don't know if that's scientifically proven or not, but they're saying it's going to take you 5 years until you can just walk into a room and, or somebody dies, or you get divorced, and you still look in the mirror and go, well, I'm someone who doesn't drink alcohol, I have to find another coping mechanism. 5 years. I relapse after 3 years, Jeremy, you know? But my understanding of what on earth was going on around alcoholism after I relapsed was so much more greater than before, when I thought I'd nailed it. So the relapse to me was actually a real powerful, majestic moment in my recovery, really.
I would agree 100%. Now, I don't believe that, relapse has to be a part of recovery. Yeah. I mean, I know people who got sober on the first shot and are 20 years sober now at this point. Now, I will put a caveat there. Those are guys that work their recovery every day, still 10 and 20 years later. Mm. That's why they have that. But
relapse. You don't mean.
What was that?
I thought you lost your train of mind, your train of thought. I was reminding you. I thought you lost your train of thought, but you didn't. You got it.
No worries. Now I have lost my train.
We were talking about relapse.
Right. For me, it was so crucial. Having that relapse was eye-opening in realizing that I had to continue working, that I had to make this a daily thing. It also was really crucial in my understanding of being able to help others who are going through recovery. At the same time, I had one more little lapse, which was almost 3 years, funny enough. Mm. It was 2 years and 9 months or so. And what I had done was I stopped working with others. I mean, direct outside of the program. Mm. I was working for the clinic, and I was helping and working with patients every day, and it got me very busy. I was commuting 6 hours a day, not one way, but 6 hours total each day to the clinic. And I was working 10 hours a day with the patients, and I'd get home and I'd be exhausted and I'd just pass out and wake up and start my commute again. So I wasn't making phone calls. I wasn't surrounding myself with my friends in recovery and the people who supported me. I started drifting away from the things that I did regularly in recovery that helped get me sober. Mm. And I started relying just on kind of working with others through my job. And it kept me sober for probably 2 years. And then for those last 9 to 10 months, man, my head was spinning. I was on the biggest dry drunk around. Wow. I was just a miserable, anxious, angry person. And I couldn't figure out why. You know, I'm sober, I'm not drinking, and I'm still falling apart. It's because I stopped doing what got it good. You know, I stopped doing the things that were helping keep me sane and keep me sober. Being able to see that the second time and see that just working with others wasn't going to work. Just hitting meetings or talking to people wasn't going to work. The entirety of recovery, the entirety of what worked for me. I love working with others in recovery. That is a cornerstone of my recovery. Keeps me out of this craziness. Hmm. You know, the more I can stay out of my head, the better. And being there for someone else does that for me without fail. self-reflection every single day, no matter how tired I am. You know, is where did I go wrong today? What did I do right? Where can I do better? I wake up every day and I just pray for guidance, you know, and for me, prayer is a big thing in my life. And for those 10 months, I wasn't praying. I wasn't talking to my higher power. I wasn't doing a thing. It was me against the world. And we know how well that works out. So it was a wonderful thing for me, both relapses. I learned and took quite a lot from them. And it's honestly one of the reasons why I feel I've been able to be of service to, you know, so many people is that experience.
Well, I'm glad that you are very open about it. I'm delighted that you came on the show. I'm going to go downstairs now and tell my wife that I met you, and she's going to get all jealous. I think it's super important, because when people have a platform, and people and celebrities have a platform to talk about this stuff, it's really important, because, you know, we talk about the kids looking at Batman and seeing Batman having a drink and thinking, oh, superhero, et cetera, having a drink. But it's also cool to see the likes of Jeremy Miller and the likes of Tom Hardy and the likes of Hugh McGregor and go, wow, they got to this level in their business, in their careers, you know, and they don't drink alcohol. You know, how cool is that, you know? So I really appreciate it. And I've loved having you as a guest on the show, Jeremy, you know, keep it up and keep talking about it and keep helping people out. You're a wonderful man.
Thank you, Lee. I really enjoyed this. This has been a great interview, and thank you for the opportunity to get to share my story, because anybody that it can help, I just want to get it to them.
When I'm next in the States at the back end of August, I'll send you an email, and if you're around in LA, we'll pop out and have a sparkling water together, mate.
Please do. I would really, really love that.
All right. You take care of yourself, Jeff. Thank you.
Thank you, Lee. I appreciate it.
If the Truth About Alcohol philosophy jives with you and you want to become someone that doesn't drink alcohol, then there are several options available to you, okay? According to the research carried out by Janice and James Prochaska, there are 6 stages of change when it comes to defeating an addiction. And let me assure you, that is your problem. It is an addiction, right? Now, these 6 stages of change are as follows. 1, pre-contemplation. 2, contemplation. 3, preparation. 4, action. 5, maintenance. And 6, termination. And translated into Truth About Alcohol philosophy, these categories become this, right? 1, the death effect. 2, visualization. 3, incubation. 4, ready, steady, go. 5, transformation. And 6, service. And that just makes a nice little acronym, STRIVE. Ha! That's why I did that, right? So these 6 stages of the Truth About Alcohol are not fixed in stone, right? They're fluid, and you'll move between these stages depending on a variety of different factors. But understanding where you are on this spectrum is really critical, okay? Now, 1, the first category you're going to be in, which the Prochaska's called pre-contemplation, and I'm calling the death effect, that's when you really are struck by the zombification of societal conditioning. You have no idea that alcohol is a problem, that alcoholism exists. You just think that alcohol is fucking brilliant, and that is the end of, right? And that will not be affecting you right now because you're here listening to this. But that is that first level, that first category, the death effect. At the second level, contemplation, as the Prochaska's call it, or for me, visualization, this is where you start to think and question the role that alcohol has in your life, right? And as you're thinking about this and you're pondering and you're kind of visualizing kind of like, you know, how alcohol is having a negative effect in your life and what it could possibly be like if it's not in your life anymore, you may have joined the Alcohol Addiction Podcast and listened to this. You may have headed over to the truthaboutalcohol.co.uk and joined our email list. You might be reading our blog post. You might have picked up a few books and started reading on those. At the third stage is called preparation, right? Or what we call incubation. And this is where you might go a little bit further. And you're now starting not only to kind of listen to podcasts and read some books, but you're actually preparing to change, right? The idea that you could potentially be someone that doesn't drink alcohol, he's starting to incubate. And you could, at this stage, have joined a community forum like Strive, or you might have joined NIST Naked Minds forum or Hip Sobriety's Facebook group or something. But you're starting to prepare for change. The fourth category is action, or what we call ready, steady, go. And this is where you really are now starting to take some real solid action. And if you're ready to take action, then you should take the Truth About Alcohol Taster. The Truth About Alcohol Taster is a 27-day program. You can join the program whenever you like. You just go to thetruthaboutalcohol.co.uk and you can find the links there to join up. Or you can email me at thetruthaboutalcohol@gmail.com and I'll sort you out. You join basically a group and you can just work on being someone who doesn't drink alcohol for 27 days to give it a little bit of a feel. We'll introduce you to the Truth About Alcohol philosophy, our three modules of truth, awareness, and freedom. We'll learn to help you see the truth about alcohol, why you drink, why it's so difficult to stop, raise awareness of that truth internally so you can start to change some of those neurological pathways, those thought process and belief systems around alcohol. And then freedom, how do you assert yourself back into a society of people that don't drink alcohol? You do the homework on Strive, you get an assignment every day from myself, and one of the Truth About Alcohol ambassadors will lead you along the way. So that's kind of the action stage. The fifth stage is called maintenance, or what we call transformation. This is where the work really takes off, right? Now, it's really important to understand that moving between the incubation phase and the ready, steady, go phase, you know, so whilst you're kind of like preparing to take action, that could take anywhere up to 6 months. And once you've started to take action, the actual maintenance phase, which is what we call transformation, the stage where you are really working on becoming someone that doesn't drink alcohol permanently, that phase can take up to 5 years, right? It can take that long. It certainly takes six months plus for you to really nail it or give yourself a good shot at this. And for that reason, we've created the intensive. The Truth About Alcohol Intensive, it's a year, an annual subscription where we get really deep into the truth about alcohol, raising awareness of that truth and working out how to be free of it. And we're up to like 70 plus coaching videos. You work with all the Truth About Alcohol ambassadors and myself. It's a great, great process, okay? One of the big mistakes people make is they'll take the taster, so they start to take action, and then once they finish the taster, they don't continue into the maintenance phase, and that can lead them fall back into some of those earlier categories. So it's really important to do the intensive and get through that transformation phase. And then finally, six, termination, as the Prochaskas call it, or I like to call it service. This is where it doesn't matter what happens now, you're never going to drink alcohol. It doesn't matter, you're never triggered, nothing ever happens, you're just fucking done with it, right? And that's where I am right now. And this is where we at the Truth About Alcohol can offer you some roles to, you know, give back to the community, give back to the world, and help me create this movement of a million people that don't drink alcohol. And that is to extend yourself into the roles of either a Strive ambassador, where you lead in the Strive movement and really are a rock helping new people come to Strive, or you can become a Truth About Alcohol ambassador, where we pay you to take control of the taster groups and the intensive groups and really work with people who are ready to take the action phase. So if you are ready right now, okay, to start to think about moving up into the next stage, so, you know, you're in contemplation phase now and you're thinking about going to preparation, join Strive, right? It's £5 a month. It'll be the best £5 you've ever spent. If you're ready to take action, if you're ready to do something about this, then join the taster. Okay, that's £99, right? Join the taster. And then if you are just ready to just fucking be someone that doesn't drink alcohol and that is like something you want to do permanently, then join the intensive. That is £1,000. We've got payment plans available. Do not let money be the reason why you do not take this, because we can always sort something out or find you some help, all right? So head over to thetruthaboutalcohol.co.uk to join those experiences, or give me an email at truthaboutalcohol@gmail.com. Remember this, folks, okay? You drink alone, but you do not have to stop drinking alone. That's why we're here for you. So reach out and help. Take care of yourself.